Did you kill Dora and Jerome Kaufman?
No, I didn't.
Did you stab them with a knife?
No, sir.
Did you punch them or hit them?
No, sir.
January 1st, 2015 started out like any other New Year's Day in Lewisburg, West Virginia. Lieutenant Jeremy Dove worked the town parade, and afterwards, he got a call that a white Suburban was driving down Interstate 64 with a stolen license plate tag. Not exactly an ordinary call, but not too unusual either. He was actually training a new officer that morning. That part was unusual, as he wasn't the normal training officer, but he was filling in and teaching this five-day-old new officer, Officer Nick Sams, the ropes. Lieutenant Dove drove them in his car over to the highway, where they parked in a turning lane and waited for the Suburban to pass. Sure enough, the Suburban went past them, closely following a red pickup truck. Lieutenant Dove pulled out onto the highway behind it and turned his lights on. The Suburban slowed down and the red truck in front of him did too. They both pulled over onto the right-hand shoulder. Lieutenant Dove stopped his car behind them and immediately called out to the driver to slowly step out of the vehicle. The driver, wearing blue jeans and a black jacket, calmly exited his vehicle and walked over to Lieutenant Dove, who told him that his license plate had been reported stolen. As Lieutenant Dove is speaking with the man, another, older man, walks along the shoulder and approaches. He had been driving the red pickup truck. A few seconds pass, and the older man suddenly pulls out a gun and starts shooting. As soon as the gunfire starts, the younger man takes off running, fleeing to the red pickup truck, whose driver's side door was still open. Lieutenant Dove is hidden his radio mic on his shoulder, and shrapnel hits him in the head. Officer Sams is shot in the back. Lieutenant Dove fires back, and the shooter is hit in the leg, incapacitated. The officers radio that a red Chevy pickup truck has just left the scene. While they wait for backup to arrive, they continue to yell out commands to the shooter.
Keep your hands away from them! Keep your hands away from them!
Backup arrived soon after. Captain Pendleton tried questioning the shooter, but he was refusing to cooperate. Another officer handed Captain Pendleton a wallet that had been found on him. The wallet had cash, credit cards, and a driver's license with the name Jerome Faulkner Sr. on them.
He's on the ground, I believe, at that point. We're looking at this ID and we're going, that's not him. You know, that was taken off him, so we know that's not who we're looking at.
Captain Pendleton ran the driver's license in their NCIC database. The info that came back listed Jerome Faulkner Sr. as a missing person from Oxford, North Carolina. The shooter was transported to the hospital. Lieutenant Dove and Officer Sams were taken to the hospital too. Their injuries, though serious, were non-life-threatening. As more officers arrived and roped off the area, others searched for the red pickup truck. And they wouldn't have to search long. About a half hour after the shots first rang out, Deputy Joshua Martin, who had responded to the scene of the shooting, got word that the truck had been found. It had crashed into a ravine about a mile or two from where they were. Deputy Martin raced over.
What I originally saw was tire tracks in the high grass on the left-hand side of the interstate. And you could see tire tracks going over a steep embankment, very, very high-pitched embankment. It was full of rocks, trees, brush, things of that nature. The vehicle, you couldn't see it from the interstate. You had to get out of your vehicle and look over the hill, and you could see the truck down over the hill.
While Deputy Martin secured the scene around it, Sergeant Vance took a closer look at the truck. The ravine was really steep. As he approached, he could see the front driver's side door was open, but he couldn't see inside. He held his position until other deputies were able to join him. One officer went to the rear and Sergeant Vance went to the driver's side. He used his baton to break the glass so he could see inside. One of the deputies on the other side did the same. In the bed of the truck, there was a tarp with chains over it in an X pattern. Padlocks were holding the chains down. Sergeant Vance again used his baton and was able to break one of the padlocks. He could immediately see a mattress with a sheet or curtain rolled up by the tailgate. It was blood-soaked. He was able to raise the mattress up, and that's when he saw the head of a man and a set of female feet. A man and a woman were lying on opposite sides, both obviously deceased. He then saw the fur of two dead animals. Sergeant Vance lowered the mattress and backed away.
At that point, we knew there was no live bodies in the truck. I just lowered the mattress back from where I was holding it, and we backed away from the truck. It was a very gruesome, bloody scene at that point. And the crime scene investigators that were going to do all the forensic stuff, it's better to leave it untouched for them.
They climbed back up to the highway, which took about 5 minutes. They were catching their breath, waiting for the canine unit, when someone radioed that they heard movement. Sergeant Vance could hear Deputy Martin yelling out commands, and then another announcement over the radio. They had their second suspect in custody.
Who did those things?
My dad.
Did you want your father to do those things?
This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 115. Earlier on that New Year's Day, Jerome Faulkner Jr. was at a fire station in Raleigh, North Carolina, where he worked as a firefighter, when he got a strange message on Facebook. The message said that he needed to call Granville County 911. Granville County was where his father lived and sometimes worked as a volunteer firefighter, even though he had been retired for years now. Jerome blew the message off, assuming that it was meant for his dad and not him. But less than a minute later, he got another message saying he needs to call immediately, that it's about his dad. He called the dispatcher and she told him that his dad's house was on fire, and they were not able to get in contact with either his dad nor his mom. He tried calling his dad's cell phone. It went straight to voicemail. So he tried his stepmom, Dora's, cell phone. Hers would ring a couple times and then go to voicemail. He tried both phones numerous times. He then went to his supervisor and told him that his dad's house was on fire and that he needed to go find out what was going on. As he was headed to his car, he got a call back from Dora's phone.
So when the phone started ringing, were you initially relieved?
Yes. I was like, oh, this is Dora's phone. They're calling me back. She got my message, you know.
Okay.
When I answered the phone, it was a male subject. He advised the power was out and he went to a hotel.
He asked why they didn't just go to their cabin when the power went out. And he said the man, who he thought was his dad, acted like he didn't know what cabin he was talking about, which he thought was strange.
He sort of blew it off. I said, well, Daddy, your house is on fire. He said, okay. I'm like, well, this ain't my daddy. In my mind, I'm sitting here thinking, this is not my daddy. So, being a firefighter, many discussions we've had about fires, I knew he would be like, well, what are you talking? He probably said a few other words in there, but he said, you know, what are you talking about? My house is on fire. But he said, okay. I'm like, Daddy, you don't sound like yourself. I said, you all right? He said, well, I got a frog in my throat.
Wow, was that strange to you?
Yes, I mean, I've never heard him use that term before. And then at that point, I said, well, let me speak to Dora. And the phone disconnected immediately.
He tried calling the number back, but now it was just going straight to voicemail, as if it had been turned off. Meanwhile, Jerome Faulkner Sr.'s neighbors were noticing the fire.
Early that morning, we were still in bed and we heard sirens and a lot of traffic going up the road. So my husband got up and looked out the window, and he could see all of the smoke from our house in the area of Jerome and Dora's house.
Granville County Sheriff's Office Deputy Mark Harrison was wearing two hats that day. One of them was as the chief of the Cornwall Volunteer Firefighters. He responded to the Faulkner home early, around 7:30 that morning, as his department, along with about three others, worked to put out the fire. He was trying to get more information on where the homeowners, Jerome and Dora Faulkner, could be. The Faulkner's red pickup truck was missing from the garage, so he called into dispatch to get a bolo, or be on the lookout, started for the couple and for the truck. He also learned that Dora's cell phone had pinged in South Boston, Virginia. He called around to hotels in that area, but no one had any records of the Faulkners having checked in anywhere. At around 11:30, Deputy Harrison left the scene. He returned a few hours later, this time not as the fire chief, but in his deputy role. He started walking around the residence, looking for more clues as to what had happened. On the back deck, he noticed spots of blood, leading to more blood. To him, it was now a crime scene.
At that point in time, I contacted Sheriff Rendell Wilkins and advised him of the situation. And by 3:40, I was putting up the inner perimeter or the first set of crime scene tape at the location and making sure everybody was cleared out from the residence.
The Faulkner's red truck was missing. Blood was on the back steps of the house. And there was that strange phone call. Where were Jerome and Dora Faulkner? After the bodies were recovered from the red pickup truck, their identifications were confirmed. They were the bodies of 73-year-old Jerome Faulkner Sr. and his wife, 62-year-old Dora Faulkner. Investigators also recovered the bodies of their two dogs. All suffered a multitude of injuries that caused their deaths. Jerome and Dora Faulkner had married in 1983. Jerome was a retired fire chief with the Cornwall Volunteer Fire Department, the very same fire department that initially responded to the house fire at the Faulkner's home. But even though he was retired, Jerome was still known to help out whenever he could. Jerome was also a deacon at a Baptist church, where he and Dora were beloved members. Dora Faulkner graduated from Vance Granville School of Nursing in 1984. She worked at Revlon as an occupational health nurse and then landed at Central Regional Hospital. She was also a first responder on the Cornwall Volunteer Fire Department for several years. Jerome and Dora were parents and grandparents, loved within their community where they often volunteered. So what happened to Jerome, Dora, and their two dogs? The shooter, the older man who had been transported to the hospital in custody, didn't voluntarily provide any answers. Investigators soon learned that he was 54-year-old Ed Campbell from Elvin, Texas. The younger man who had fled the scene in the red pickup truck was his son, 21-year-old Eric Campbell. Eric was cooperating with investigators, and the story he told was harrowing. Eric said his father, who was out on bail after a domestic violence incident with his wife, was abusive to him all of his life. He said he had accompanied him on a trip where he broke into the Faulkners' home, which he had randomly chosen, and beat and killed both of them, along with their two dogs. Eric said he hadn't done anything, that it was all his father, and that he was scared that his father would hurt him if he tried to stop him, or if he didn't help. Both Ed and Eric were charged with murder, but only one of them would go to trial. That's because in March 2016, Ed Campbell committed suicide from his jail cell. He left his son Eric to face the charges and possibly the death penalty alone. In July 2017, Eric Campbell sat at the defense table in a courtroom in Granville County, North Carolina. His charges included first-degree murder, arson, burglary, and car theft. If convicted, he could face the death penalty. In her opening statements, Granville County Assistant District Attorney Allison Capps said that on New Year's Eve 2014, Jerome and Dora Faulkner spent their last moments fighting for their lives against a brutal attack by two men, an attack they never saw coming.
December the 31st of 2014, the night we believe the evidence will show you that evil descended upon 8067 Highway 96 North here in Oxford. In the Cornwall community, the night that innocence and security died in that community.
She said the path that led to this was filled with deliberate decisions and choices by Eric and his father. She said it started in September 2014 when Ed brutally assaulted his wife, Holly, in Alvin, Texas. Ed was arrested and put into jail, awaiting trial for charges of aggravated assault. On December 8, 2014, Ed was bailed out of jail by his two sons, Eric and Nick. Eric had been gathering up his belongings and selling things so he could bond his father out. 10 days later, on December 18th, Ed didn't show up for his court date. Instead, on December 24th, he stole a Suburban from a school bus lot. She said Eric made the choice to leave Texas with his father in that stolen Suburban. They then made a stop at a Home Depot in Greenville, South Carolina, where they purchased drain cleaner, which was later sprayed all over Jerome's body. They also purchased a sprayer to put chemicals in, muriatic acid, chains, padlocks, and U-bolts. Conscious choices, Cap said, deliberate decisions. On December 29th, they continued on their trip to Kannapolis, North Carolina, where they went to a Walmart and purchased gloves and goggles, things you would need to suit up if you were going to use the chemicals they had just purchased, she said. For the next 3 days through December 31st, they stayed in Hillsboro, North Carolina, before making their way to Oxford, North Carolina. She said a neighbor had spoken to Dora and Jerome on the phone around 6:15 p.m. on December 31st. Jerome and Dora had called to check on the woman's husband and others in the community, as they often did. This was the last time anyone talked to them again. Cap said the medical examiner will testify about the plethora of injuries Jerome and Dora suffered and the injuries their two dogs sustained, too. After they brutally murdered them, Cap said Ed and Eric then looted and pillaged the Faulkner's home. Eric drove to Walmart and Ed went inside and purchased huge Rubbermaid totes to fill up all of Jerome and Dora's belongings. They also purchased lanterns, lantern fuel, and propane, things you would need to burn down a house. She said they then stole Jerome's truck and put their bodies in it, along with the bodies of their dogs. They made several stops as they drove out of town.
Several stops, but I don't think that the evidence will ever show you that anybody, this defendant or his father, asked for help. Alert anybody to what's going on. Conscious choices, deliberate decisions.
She said the path of destruction ended in Lewisburg, West Virginia, when the Suburban's stolen license plate tag triggered the tag reader and Lewisburg police were alerted. She told the jury that Eric is guilty of first-degree murder, cruelty to the Faulkners' dogs, arson of their home, burglary, and robbery. Eric's defense attorney, William Durham, said Eric did not kill Jerome and Dora Faulkner, that his father did, and Eric was just a witness.
During this case, you will learn how all kinds of different folks interacted with Ed Campbell and what they did to stay safe from him. Because Ed Campbell was mean. And Ed Campbell was cruel. Ed Campbell was the kind of guy that could just hurt you without hesitation.
He said Ed was first married to Valerie, Eric's mother. They had three kids, Nick, Eric, and Michelle. But he said Michelle died at 5 weeks old, under mysterious circumstances. When Eric was four, Eric's mother Valerie suffered a brain injury, an aneurysm. Again, another mysterious circumstance, he said. She was confined to a wheelchair, couldn't communicate, and was ultimately placed into a nursing home. Eric and Nick were left in the sole care of their father.
And growing up in the home of Ed Campbell was a scary place. You will hear that Ed Campbell threatened his neighbors, an 86-year-old man, his neighbor. Ed walked right up to his face and said, "I'm going to kill you." And he didn't even know why, the neighbor. Didn't even know why. Ed Campbell was a scary guy to have live next door to.
He said Ed had multiple girlfriends after Valerie and abused every one of them. He also assaulted other adults and his own kids.
And that was Eric's childhood growing up. You put too much sugar in the Kool-Aid, and Ed Campbell, his father, would throw it on the ground, tell you to clean it up, kick you while you're down there.
He said the Department of Social Services in Texas got involved, and Nick and Eric were briefly put into foster care. Despite the department's finding that they were neglected and physically abused, Ed took some classes, attended some court hearings, and then got custody back.
That's what Eric always experienced. Whether Ed was beating a girlfriend, threatening a neighbor, hitting someone with a tire tool, when it was over, Eric Campbell was back in his dad's control.
He said Eric learned how to stay safe from his father. He learned to be passive. But despite this, he loved his father. Because that's what children do. Family relationships are complicated, even in healthy situations, Durham said. After Ed jumped bail after being bonded out by his sons, he wanted to get out of town. Durham said Eric wanted to keep him off of drugs and keep him from committing suicide, which Ed had threatened to do if he had to go back to jail. So Eric got in the stolen Suburban with his dad, hoping for the best. Durham said when they randomly got to the Faulkner's house, Eric thought his dad was just going to rob them. But when he heard a gunshot, just like all the times when he was a kid, Eric couldn't imagine what was happening. He was terrified and helpless. Ed killed the Faulkners and their dogs. Eric didn't watch. He couldn't process it. But he did help his dad put the bodies in the truck. After Eric got pulled over and Ed approached the officers with the gun, Eric took off, Durham said, because although he loves his dad, there are simply things he will not do. He will not shoot or kill people for his dad. He said after Eric crashed the truck, he grabbed some of the Faulkner's property that was on the seat next to him and stumbled into the woods, where he sat for a half hour.
And he's trying to think. He's trying to figure out what he's done. He's ashamed, and he's scared, and he's terrified. And he's thinking, what's happened? And he realizes, I didn't back my dad up. And he's worried, is my dad going to come get me?
He just wanted it to be over, Durham said. So he came out of the woods, where police then arrested him. Durham explained that both Ed and Eric were transferred back to North Carolina to face charges. Everyone knew that Ed was the killer, he said. But the prosecution's strategy changed after Ed committed suicide. Eric was just a witness, a bystander, he said. Everything he did to survive, out of fear. The sins of the father should not be visited upon the son, he concluded. As part of the prosecution's case, they called the many police officers to the stand who had been involved in the arrests of Ed and Eric Campbell. Officer Nick Sams, the rookie cop who had been shot in the back, testified that he didn't fire any shots that day, but he did draw his weapon. In addition to taking a bullet to the back, shrapnel also hit him in his forehead and ear. He was asked if Eric ever asked him for help after he was first pulled over.
Did Eric Campbell ask you for help out there on the interstate?
No, ma'am.
Did Eric Campbell tell you that there were two dead bodies in the back of that red truck?
No, ma'am.
Did he tell you that his father was armed?
No, ma'am.
Trooper Christopher Wade with the West Virginia State Police testified that he went to the scene the next day and found Dora Faulkner's wallet, pocketbook, jewelry, keys, and credit cards buried in the wood line in the median, right near where Eric had crashed the pickup truck. There was also a .22 caliber pistol buried with them. Gary Edmonds was Eric's boss at a cooling and heating company. He testified that Eric came to work for him in September 2014. He was also going to school at a local college. He said Eric was bright and was always on time. Eric rode with him in his work van, and they went to several calls together. When asked if Eric ever talked about his father, Gary said he mentioned him every now and then. He recalled Eric's dad calling him while he was at work, and Eric being irritated by that. He said Eric would tell his dad he was irritated. In late November 2014, he said Eric was selling a bunch of his stuff so he could try and get his father out of jail. Eric was in a car accident at some point after, and December 19th, 2014 was his last paycheck. He came over to Gary's house unexpectedly on December 24th, which must have been hours before he left town with his dad. He came to pick up his last check, and he told Gary that he didn't know what his plans were, but that he would like to come back to work eventually, just not right then. Holly Smook, formerly Holly Campbell, was Ed's second wife and Eric's stepmom. She testified that Ed and his sons were very tight. They were always together doing things like gaming and camping. She said she was absolutely an outsider in their relationship. As for her relationship with the boys, she said it was friendly, but that they all made it very clear to her that they already had a mom and that she did not need to discipline them. She said she never took on the role as stepmom with them because none of them, not Ed, Nick, nor Eric, wanted her to.
While you were dating Edward and living in the home, did you witness any what you would describe as physical abuse by Edward on Eric or Nicholas?
No.
Was there physical discipline?
Yes.
And what did you see what did that look like?
When they were younger, he would spank them if they misbehaved.
Would he spank them with his hand?
No, he would use a belt.
Did he spank them on a particular part of their body?
On their buttocks and the back of their legs.
Did you see any other form of physical punishment?
No.
She said when they were too old to spank, Ed would get in their faces and be very loud. But she said she never saw any bruises on them, and they never said anything to her about any abuse. She and Ed married in 2005, and they had three kids together in 2007, 2009, and 2010. She recalled that in 2007, Ed lost his nursing license after he was stopped on the side of the road and cops found him with syringes and vials in his pocket. She said he had taken them from one of the units he had been working in. He then got a trucking license, but it was difficult to find jobs that paid well. And it was expensive owning a truck. He tried starting several businesses, but wasn't successful. She said Eric was a typical teenager. He didn't want to go to high school, but he was smart. He did 1 year of homeschooling, his freshman year, which she said wasn't successful, and then he went back and graduated. As for why he was homeschooled that year, she said his older brother Nick had told him that being a freshman was horrible. And so he didn't want to go. After Eric moved out, she said he would come back to the house all the time. She was asked if Eric and his dad ever got into verbal altercations, and she said yes, but they never got physical.
A lot of posturing. Edward would be right in his face, swearing, yelling.
But would he put his hands on him that you saw?
No, they do the chest thumping.
Did Eric participate in that as well?
He would yell back.
Did he chest bump back that you saw?
No.
She was asked if Ed ever yelled at her, and she said yes. It would be the same sort of in-your-face yelling. She said he wasn't like that at first, that it only started the last 2 years they were together, in the beginning of 2012. She told the jury that Ed was taking antidepressants and Adderall, which were prescribed to him. In 2012, she said Ed started to become depressed. He was very irritable, wouldn't sleep, didn't want to hang out with any of their friends, and stayed home a lot. He got very paranoid the last 3 or 4 months they were together, during the summer of 2014.
He would accuse me of having affairs. He felt that people were spying on him.
On September 19th, 2014, Ed assaulted her in their home. She said she got home around 6 or 6:30, and when she walked in, she saw the house was a mess. Her oldest daughter said she hadn't gone to school, and so she asked Ed about that. Ed started arguing with her and said she didn't need to go to school.
We continued to argue about that, and he became very upset and hit me.
And where did he hit you?
The face.
She said she was in the kitchen and her children were nearby. They continued arguing and decided to go into the bedroom so they wouldn't be around the kids. She said when they got to the bedroom, he threatened to kill her.
He wanted me to admit that I was having an affair. He pulled out a gun and said that he would shoot me if I didn't admit it.
Were you having an affair?
No.
Did he name anybody specifically that he thought you were having, with whom he thought you were having an affair?
No, he just thought it was somebody from work.
He told her that this was it, that he was going to kill her. She asked him if she could at least say goodbye to the kids.
Did you believe he would kill you?
Yes.
Had he ever threatened you like that before?
No.
He called the kids into the room one at a time. He told her that if she gave the indication that something was wrong, that he would kill her in front of them, and that it would traumatize them forever.
I hugged them and tried talking with them for a little while until Ed said that's enough and he would send one out and call the next one in.
So you did it one by one?
Yes.
She said Ed was standing with his gun behind him so it wouldn't scare the kids. He then told her that he wanted to call either Nick or Eric to come get the kids because he didn't want them to be in the house with her body. He took her upstairs to the computer room so he could call them. It was there where he hit her again and asked why she was doing this to him. She told him that she wasn't cheating, that he could look at her emails and text messages, that there was nothing. He made her sit in a chair and look at the computer. She had trouble turning it on, and so he tipped the chair over and knelt on her chest. They then went down to the kitchen. Ed kept going from room to room in the house. He was trying to find proof that she was cheating. She said there was no reasoning with him at all. They ended up back upstairs, and then Eric came over.
Edward said that if he didn't want to clean up blood, he needed to leave now.
And what happened?
Eric left.
She said Eric had seen her and Ed get into verbal altercations before, but never physical. She said by that time it was common for them to verbally fight. She said Ed took her into the shed and then put a noose around her neck. He hit her a bunch of times with a metal pipe and asked how he could get into her workplace. He rigged up a dead man's weight, where if she moved off of the chair, she would be strangled to death. She told him how to get into her work, and he took her office keys and her badge and left. He came back about 45 minutes later and saw that she had gotten an arm free. He hit her some more with the pipe and then took her into the house. He then kept saying he was tired. She told him that they should just go to bed, that it had been a long night and they could deal with it in the morning.
So all of these things that started at 6 o'clock and you're moving upstairs and all around the house and outside, is this taking place over hours of time?
Yes, it was constant moving from one room to another, just listening to him rant and ask me for the proof. And
Ed finally agreed to go lie down. They went back to the bedroom and he laid there for a long time with a gun on his chest, pointed at her. He had sent the kids upstairs to their rooms. He then fell asleep.
I just waited until he was actually asleep. And then when he was asleep, I got up and he'd left a gun on the table and I took it because I didn't want the kids to find it. And I took a gun and I got in the car and I drove to my daughter's school.
How far is your daughter's school from your home?
4 or 5 miles.
Why did you drive there?
We live out in the country, and that's the closest place. That's not a county road. That's got lights and people around.
She then called 911. It was about 5:30 in the morning. The sheriff met her at the school and asked her to drive with them to the house so she could point it out. They had her wait at the end of the driveway while they went in and arrested him. She was asked if Ed took his prescriptions regularly, and she said no. She knew that because when he would take his meds, he was his old self. When he didn't take them, he was moody and depressed. She spoke with Nick after Eric was arrested for the murders. Nick wanted her help in bailing Eric out of jail. He told her that it was her fault that Eric was in jail, that the fight between her and Ed had spilled over onto Eric. He then reached out to her again twice, asking her for money. She never gave him any. She said she was never notified that Ed had committed suicide. She only found out when a friend called and told her it was on the news. On cross-examination, Eric's attorney, William Durham, asked Holly if Ed had told her that his two sons had been taken by CPS in 2000. She said yes. He then asked her if Ed had told her about another time when he was found in the bathroom with a needle in his arm and his children had been taken away yet again. She said no, she was only aware of the one time. Durham then questioned her about whether she knew Ed was manufacturing meth in their home. She said she did not know anything about that. However, she admitted that she would sometimes purchase Sudafed for him and for the household. Sudafed is a main ingredient when making meth, and there are government restrictions on how much someone can purchase. Durham pointed out that the September attack lasted for almost 12 hours, to which she agreed. She said Ed let her go to the bathroom, but he stood right outside. She agreed that she was physically trapped inside that house and could not leave. You considered Ed Campbell to be a danger to you, even after the assault, isn't that correct? Holly said yes. He was not himself. He was a completely different person. She agreed he was out of control. After the attack, she said police took her and her kids to a shelter for protection. She said she wanted to make sure that Ed didn't know where they were. Jose Rebellis, an officer with the University of Texas Police in Houston, helped place Holly in a home after her stay in that shelter. Holly worked as a nurse at a cancer center at the university, and he found out that Holly's husband had taken her work keys during a domestic assault. His unit interviewed her and determined that they needed to develop a protective plan for her. They basically made her disappear from their records, even though she was still employed there. They then moved her out of the women's shelter and found her a new place to live. They changed where she parked her vehicle at work, and they escorted her into her building each day. He testified that Holly was concerned that her husband might come back and hurt or even kill her. He said she included her two stepsons, Eric and Nick, too, because they were close to Ed.
So did this safety plan include safeguards to prevent all three of them from knowing where Holly Smook was?
Yes, it did.
Ed was still in jail when they put Holly on this plan. On December 8th, he posted bond. About a week or 10 days later, there was a hearing. They escorted Holly to the hearing. The court revoked Ed's bond after he failed to show up, and he became a wanted man. Rebella said they made efforts to find and arrest him for the safety of Holly and the other employees. On December 24th, he decided to go surveil the Campbell House in Alvin, Texas. They thought it would be a good place to locate Ed and pick him up on the warrant. But instead of Ed, he ran into Eric and had a word with him.
And my parting words to Eric were to stay away from his father because he was going to get him in trouble.
Why did you want to tell him that?
Because his father was not wanted, and I didn't know how much support he was going to give his father.
In many cases, DNA can often be a smoking gun and can help juries determine whether they believe a defendant really committed the crime. But in this case, the DNA wasn't much help to the prosecution. In the Suburban and pickup truck that the two Campbell men had been driving, there were numerous items that had belonged to the Faulkners, including even one of the murder weapons, a crossbow. It was somewhat easy for prosecutors to make the connection between the Faulkner home and the property that was in possession of the Campbells when they were arrested. But as for the ability to tie Eric directly to the murders, that was a little harder, given that none of Eric's DNA was found on any of the assumed weapons, including that crossbow. But when asked by the prosecutor if DNA could be destroyed by a fire or a strong acid, a DNA analyst said it could. As for fingerprints, no fingerprints on the weapons were able to be found either. Prosecutors pointed to the purchase of gloves at a Walmart the day before the murders as a possible reason why. The last testimony from the state was by the pathologists who examined the bodies of Jerome and Dora and their two dogs. Allison Tucker testified that both dogs had been beaten and stabbed, and one of them even appeared to have been hanged. Dr. Susan Venuti, the medical examiner who performed the autopsy on Dora, said there were multiple blunt force trauma wounds to her head and face, as well as stab wounds to her torso. She also had a plastic glove stuffed into her mouth. Dr. Nabila Haikal conducted the autopsy on Jerome. She said he too was beaten and stabbed. An arrow from a crossbow had been broken off in his chest and was recovered during the autopsy. Jerome also had a gunshot wound to his left leg and chemical burns all over his body. She said he was found with a plastic bag over his head and may have been asphyxiated as well. All horrible, gruesome deaths. Before trial, the defense had been dealt a pretty big blow to their case. Before Ed Campbell committed suicide, during one of his transports from jail to a courthouse, Ed had a conversation with the officer who transported him. And in it, he took full responsibility for what happened and said his son didn't have a part in it. According to the transcript, Ed said, quote, "That boy didn't have anything to do with this North Carolina shit I'm going in for. You aren't going to find any prints from him anywhere around there." He also said, "He had some suspicions, but I'm an authoritarian dad, and he's not going to question me. He was trying to get me to go back to Texas." In fact, Ed said that the reason he fired at the officers was because his son was innocent. "When they were first pulling over, I was thinking I could let him go to jail and then bail him out, but he was terrified. That is why I did what I did. I didn't offer him the opportunity to leave with them. That's the only reason I stopped. Otherwise, I would have made a clean getaway." Despite his comments, the judge ruled that they would not be able to come in at trial. The judge said Ed had clear motivation to lie and to try to get his son off. He may have also been already planning on committing suicide, which is why he would want to save his son. During trial, the defense again tried to get these statements in, but again, they were ruled inadmissible. So the defense called Eric to the stand, to testify about what he calls an abusive childhood and to tell the jury what he says really happened to Jerome and Dora Faulkner. He told the jury that his father used drugs throughout his entire life and that his mom had a brain aneurysm when he was young.
She was confined to a wheelchair, electric wheelchair. My first remembered memory of her is her telling me that she's hungry, and I can barely open the refrigerator, and I pull out a slice of ham and cheese to feed her. And the other is having to brush her teeth. She could barely speak, couldn't move.
He said he and his brother Nick had to obey and listen to their dad. That's how life was, he said.
For basically about any kind of mistake a boy could make, you were hit. If he was feeling more formal, he'd take you to the bedroom and strip you down from your waist and just go ham with the belt. Sometimes he'd turn it around and use the metal end. That's basically when he was done, you were black. From the bottom of your legs to the back of your neck.
When asked if his father ever hit him with an object, he said quite a few. He said one time he hit him with a screwdriver and a gun. He said as a child, he was very shy, friendly, respectful. He said he wet the bed for quite a long time in his life and would throw up a lot. If he didn't make it to the toilet to throw up in time, he said his dad would start beating him. He said whenever he would start crying, his dad would say he would give him something to cry about and then hit him until he stopped. He said he was afraid of his dad, and whenever his dad told him to do something, he had to run to it. He said he didn't complain or cry. When he was in the sixth grade, he said he was prescribed Adderall. He said it changed him. One of the effects was that it made him better able to control his crying. His grades went up, and he could sit still in the classrooms. Life was generally better, he said. He took it until the end of seventh grade, until his dad started to take it from him. His dad then started to take it instead. When he was 10 or 11, Holly came to live with them. He said the first year was pretty decent. They would bake desserts and she taught him how to sew. By that point, his mom had been moved to a nursing home after getting into an argument with his dad. After his dad and Holly's first daughter was born, things changed. His dad convinced him to start homeschooling instead of going to high school for his freshman year. He said he would study and learn on his own time, but his main responsibility was taking care of his baby half-sister. He said Holly would work weekends and his dad was always home. He would try and start his own businesses, and he also started making meth at home. Eric said one day, after he had moved out, he came home to visit and no one was home. Not the kids, not Holly, nor his dad. He and his brother Nick found out that Ed had been charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. He said he and his brother went to visit their dad in jail.
I'd always, when the time was coming to visit, I usually didn't want to go, but I had to go.
During the visits, he said his dad would yell at them, or he would stare at them through the glass and start beating himself with his fists. He said his dad wanted them to sell things inside the house so they could bond him out. He told Eric to ask other people for money, but he said he told his dad that they didn't have any. It wasn't true. He didn't actually ask them because he didn't want other people to have to incur debt for his father. He said his dad told them that they would be sorry if they didn't get him out, that he was going to die in there. I guess he did, he said. A recording of two of those jail visits were played for the jury. In this clip, you can hear Ed getting agitated.
I can't do every fucking goddamn thing in here, okay? I have very limited resources.
In another clip, you can hear bumping noises. Eric testified that that was Ed hitting himself with the phone. Eric told the court that he got into a car accident in December and he had whiplash and was going to physical therapy for it. He said he, his dad, and Nick met up at a campfire after his father was bonded out of jail. He said his dad talked about wanting to go camping indefinitely. He said his dad gave him a list of items to get from the house so he could go on the lam on that camping trip. He said a dry suit and flippers were on the list, along with camping supplies and weapons. He said he remembers a crossbow being on there too. He collected the items and went to go pick his dad up.
I didn't have a definite plan whether I was going to go with him or not. It was more of along the lines that we started driving and he really, really wanted me to go along. And
why did you go along?
I thought he was he was having some serious emotional problems. And he made me feel I could fix it.
He said his dad was talking about how he would have to kill himself if he had to go back to jail. He acknowledged knowing that his dad was on the run from the police. At the start of the trip, they were in his brother Nick's car. But soon after, his dad told him to stop at an apartment complex, and they switched over to a white Suburban. His dad told him to leave his phone and keys in his brother's car, so he did. He said he didn't know that his dad had stolen the Suburban. His dad said that he had gotten it for a really cheap price. They then went to a Home Depot in South Carolina. His dad told him that he just wanted to pick up some supplies. They purchased chains, household cleaners, and a sprayer. Eric said he thought his dad wanted to use those items to make more meth. They then went to a Walmart where they purchased goggles and gloves. He said they were items his dad had always used to make meth. He said his dad didn't get Sudafed, however, and he thought maybe he was getting through to him that it wasn't a good idea. There wasn't anything about this presented in the prosecution's case, but Eric said they went to a sporting goods store as well, where they looked at warm clothes and got more bow and arrows for hunting. They were planning on living on the land, he said. He said they would pull the car over and sleep in various spots, pieces of land that were somebody's, but no houses were nearby. His dad kept talking about money, saying they needed more. He wanted to start making his drugs again, and even talked about robbing people. Eric said his main reason for being on the trip with him was to keep him from doing those sorts of things. They were driving towards the mountains, away from Texas, and they ended up stopping for the night and randomly parking in an empty field by the Faulkner's home in Oxford. They both got out to see if the area was good for the night. His dad popped open the trunk and started grabbing stuff that they would use to camp in a backpack. He also grabbed a crossbow, which Eric said he thought his dad was going to use to try and catch a deer. His dad then handed him a shoulder bag, and they walked along the edge of the field and entered the woods. He said he opened up his bag to see what was in it. There was a water bottle, a telescope, and a break-apart spear. They continued on. His dad ran ahead of him. It was almost fully dark by this point. He ran after his dad and they ended up in the Faulkner's yard. His dad walked up to the front door and rang the doorbell. Eric was still around the corner of the house. After his dad rang the doorbell, his dad then ran and hid. Lights came on and a man came out of the front door. The man then went back inside after not seeing anything. His dad went back and rang the doorbell again. This time his dad waited there. The man answered the door again and he heard his dad say their truck was broken down and he asked to use their phone. Eric said they didn't have any phones on them, so he thought maybe his dad truly did just want to call somebody. His dad walked into the house.
I started hearing yelling. Yelling come from the house, screaming. People saying, "Get out of my house. You're not welcome here."
What else did you hear?
I heard people by these windows. I was at the corner of the house and hearing someone yell, "We don't have any money. We don't have anything. Just get out."
Then what did you hear?
Somebody screaming, "God help us," and a gunshot.
He said he was afraid that his dad was robbing someone and that someone had just been shot. He said he didn't know what to do, whether to run or stay where he was, or maybe see if anyone had been shot. He stayed where he was. He has no idea how long he stood there, but his dad came back out, grabbed him by his coat, and said something about family and about backing him up. He then pulled him inside.
There was there's liquid on the floor. So there was a living room. There was nobody in there. So a hallway. There was some kind of nightstand in the hallway. And the bedroom was two people.
And you now know those two people to be Mr. Jerome Faulkner and Ms. Dora Faulkner, is that right?
Yes.
He was asked when he went into the bedroom and saw them, what they looked like.
They look like they're in pain. Man, Jerome had an arrow coming out of his chest.
And do you remember what Ms. Faulkner looked like?
He said he remembers seeing the arrow in the man's chest and thinking that it's not supposed to be there.
It's not supposed to be an arrow, you know. It's not supposed to be an arrow there. And my dad's back. He reloaded an arrow. And kept telling the other person that was on the bed to make this easy. Just screams.
He said he was afraid and didn't know which way to turn. A woman screamed and then it was silent. His dad swung something and then came over to him, ripped off the backpack he was wearing, and sent him to the living room.
Did you try to fight your father and stop him from doing this? I'm sorry, you're going to have to answer.
No, I didn't.
Why not?
Because it happened very fast. I didn't know what to do.
He said he heard dog whimpers coming from the room. He walked back to the room and he could see his dad with that spear he had in his backpack, and he was hitting them. He said he ducked back out before his dad could see him. Because he didn't tell me to go to the doorway, he said. He went back to the living room and waited until his dad came out again.
He started saying that he was burning. And he's stripping off some of his clothes. He's telling me how the item that sprayer would have made a good threat, but it made an even better weapon. Until it had burst on him.
He said until it burst on him?
It wouldn't stop spraying.
He said his dad put his arms around him and started talking about what happened. He said he was glad there weren't any kids there because killing kids is hard. He then took Eric to the office and sat him down.
I remember just asking him. I don't know if I asked him why or if he just saw the look on my face. And he just said he wanted money.
Eric said his dad told him to start going through the file cabinets and to look for papers dealing with identity and bank accounts. So he did. He was asked if his dad had threatened him in any way.
Not at the moment. Beyond him pulling me inside the house and telling me that family is supposed to back each other up, that there's only
pilots and co-pilots, and anybody else is just loose weight.
As for why his dad had chosen that house, Eric said his dad told him that he had seen a man at the end of the driveway in a truck that he wanted, and he didn't know whether or not they were going to be there. After a while, he said his dad mentioned Michelle, Eric's baby sister, who had passed away at just 5 weeks old.
I remember him mentioning that. He said Michelle, and I said she died when I was not even born. And he said, oh, is that what happened? And he told me that she had issues with breathing, and that she was most likely not going to make it too much longer. He thought that he didn't want to live with a mentally handicapped child. And he said that he snuffed her.
As for the trip to Walmart, which occurred around midnight, he said his dad instructed him where to drive. His dad told him that if he tried to run, he doesn't have the same excuse as Holly did. He would never kill her, he said, because she was the mother of his children. His dad instructed him to wait in the car as he went into Walmart. Eric said he didn't want to drive away because he was afraid his dad was watching him and would come out and start shooting if he tried to leave. When his dad came back, he had a bunch of items in a big blue tote. They went back to the Faulkners. They spent the next few hours packing up the Faulkners' belongings. When asked why he did that, he said because he had to. There was no other choice, he said. He then described how his dad told him that they needed to move the bodies, so he helped him move them into the truck.
Now, did your dad tell you any reason why he wanted their bodies?
At the time, no.
Did he ever tell you any reason? What did he tell you the reason was?
He was going to make a mask of his face and wear it.
What did you think when your dad told you that was his plan?
It's crazy.
He said his dad kept telling him that they can't do anything about them now, that they're already dead. They were at the house until sunrise. Eric sat in the car at his dad's instruction while his dad set the house on fire. His dad then got into the red pickup truck and told Eric to stay on his ass. They then left. They stopped at a couple gas stations. His dad instructed him to go inside and to get a map. Surveillance video from all of their stops during the entire trip had been played during the prosecution's case. But aside from the date, times, and what they purchased, it was often grainy and difficult to make out. There was one from the Sheets gas station, however, where Eric can be seen walking inside, his face covered and wearing a hood. He was asked why he tried to cover his face, and he said his dad had told him to keep his face covered.
And when you were in that Sheets, did you tell the clerk to call the police?
No.
Why not?
My dad was right across the street.
And why was that the reason? And if you would tell me more of why that is the reason you didn't tell him to call the police.
He just killed two people.
What was going through your mind? What did you think would happen if you said something like that?
There was no reason why he wouldn't just walk right in there and start shooting.
On cross-examination, Granville District Attorney Mike Waters pointed out that in his interview with police shortly after he was arrested, Eric said he saw his dad shoot Jerome with a crossbow. But in his testimony, he said Jerome had already been shot with the crossbow, and he only saw it sticking out of his chest.
Would it help to look at the copy of the transcript? Would that refresh your recollection?
I believe it is what you are reading it as.
Well, I mean, it's not what I said, it's what you said, isn't it?
If I got the order wrong, I'm sorry.
Waters pointed out that when Eric talked to detectives, he told them that he saw what had happened. But in his testimony, he was saying his dad told him what happened. Waters offered to show Eric the transcript of that interview.
Sir, I got it. I know that's what it says.
Well, That's what it says because that's what you told Sergeant Baker. Is that right?
I tried to get everything in the right order, and I probably did not.
Okay.
I know I did not.
But most importantly, you got everything in the right order this time because you were actually in the house when this was happening. Is that right?
No, it's not right.
Well, how did you know everything was happening if you were outside at the corner of the house?
Because my dad explained everything to me when I was in the office.
All right, but you didn't tell them that, did you? You recounted it in the first person, didn't you?
So I tried to tell them everything that happened.
Eric said he knows he was talking in the first person to detectives, but that he was just trying to tell them everything he could. Waters then pointed out that the two conversations that were played for the jury of Eric's jailhouse visits with his father weren't representative of the majority of visits, that the majority of visits were actually pleasant. Eric said he doesn't know. Waters also brought up how on direct, Eric had said that his dad would steal his Adderall pills. Waters noted that on September 19th, 2006, Ed took his son to his doctor's appointment. The chief complaint in the doctor notes was that Ed felt that Eric's dose needed to be decreased and just needed the lowest dose that works. Okay, Eric responded. After Eric's testimony, the defense called Lee Hagen to the stand. Dr. Hagen is a psychologist who interviewed Eric for 5 hours in February 2015. He said multiple psychologists had diagnosed Eric with chronic PTSD, starting when he was just 8 years old. He said his determination was that Eric was so afraid of his dad that he never challenged or questioned him. He said the abuse substantially accounts for Eric's conduct during what happened to the Faulkners.
Eric endured reasonable fear that he would suffer immediate death or bodily injury if he didn't submit to his father's will.
Ayesha Chowdhury, a psychiatrist at Duke University, testified that the way Eric was abused when he was a child and his relationship with his dad is important to understanding this case.
So a lifetime of being the victim of physical and emotional traumatic just abuse on a daily basis, of being beaten to the point where he was beaten into submission. And then witnessing this horrible act of violence committed by the father who had committed acts of violence to him, and then being told that his father had also killed his sibling, which he had never known before that. So, yes, I think it's very significant that the perpetrator of this this act of violence, this horrific crime, was also a person that Eric had suffered from violence as a result of his actions.
She was asked if Eric had the mental capacity to form an intent to kill.
My opinion is that due to being incapacitated by his symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, as well as being incapacitated by the chronic effects of post-traumatic stress disorder, that when faced with the events of that night, he was unable to have the ability to exercise appropriate judgment or caution.
She said that, in fact, Eric didn't have the mental capacity to form intent for any of the charges he was facing. He was horrified by the nature of the events that he had witnessed. He was horrified that he had not been able to do anything to intervene, she said. The defense also called people who had witnessed Ed Campbell's abusive behavior to the stand. One of them was Linda Lamott, who was Ed's former live-in girlfriend prior to his relationship with Holly. Linda said she is still affected by her 2-year relationship with Ed, saying she can't breathe sometimes when she talks about it. She said Ed did abuse Eric.
Eric especially was very frightened when he'd hear his dad call him. He would wet his pants and sometimes have a bowel movement, and his we had a huge plastic container for him filled with diapers, and you know, an 8-year-old boy you know, went on, you know, I was there, lived with him several years, so.
She said she loved the boys, that they called her mom. She was also asked if Ed was ever abusive to her.
He was violent. Very violent.
At some point, did you decide to leave Ed Camper?
I tried many times. It was very difficult, and I couldn't. We didn't have phones. He didn't take the cords. We couldn't use the phone. I couldn't leave. I couldn't visit family. If I tried to leave, he'd almost kill me.
One incident got so violent that she pressed charges against him. She said she eventually left. Shane Warman was Eric's closest and best friend. He said they met at about 7 or 8 years old and that he lived right behind the Campbell home. They were friends all the way up until this happened. He told the court that Eric would tell him how abusive his father was.
He told me about times of him stomping on his head. Ed stomping on Eric's head. When Eric was not obedient or did what he was told, there were times when Ed would get angry and he'd just flip out. If anyone was present, he would send them away. He'd punch holes in the walls, kick holes in the walls, throw furniture, break things.
He called Ed very aggressive, confrontational, and demanding. He would scream loud if you didn't do what he said and get up in your face to the point where he would spit on you. That's how Ed was. He was aggressive, he said. He said he knew Ed was making meth and used his children to make it too. He said Ed would even offer him some. Nick Campbell, Eric's brother, also testified on his behalf. He said Ed was definitely violent.
When my dad attacked us, we would have to pray to his mercy and let him finish.
He said he decided his best defense from his father was to disconnect from him. He left the home, but still tried to maintain a relationship with him. He corroborated Eric's testimony about how his father would threaten them about getting him out of jail and say that he would even kill himself. He said he decided to not go on the trip with his father.
I knew my dad was not emotionally right, and I was frightened of him.
On cross, Nick admitted that the first time he had ever told anyone about the abuse was after Eric was arrested for murder. The prosecution called their own forensic psychologist during their rebuttal case. Dr. Nicole Wolfe said that Eric's behavior throughout the trip with his father was not consistent with someone suffering from PTSD, including when he was pulled over by the police and when he hid the Faulkner's belongings after crashing the red truck.
So this is another example, and what's relevant about this one is that this is during a time when it's only him. This is his father's not right there. This is only Eric Campbell acting on this.
Does this show the ability to make decisions?
Yes.
The ability to think intentionally?
Yes.
To set a goal and make a decision to take you to that particular goal?
I believe it does, yes.
And if you don't meet one particular goal, start afresh and make a new goal?
Yes.
In his closing arguments, Eric's attorney said the state has not proven that Eric is guilty.
Now, to prove that Eric Campbell was guilty of first-degree murder, the state has to prove one of two things. They have to prove either that Eric Campbell joined in a common plan with his father to break into the Faulkner's home and steal their property, and that his father killed the Faulkner. Or they have to prove that Eric personally used a weapon and violently killed the Faulkner. And the state cannot do that. They simply have not proven that in this case, and they can't do it because Eric Campbell had no intent to rob, to hurt, to steal.
The prosecutor, however, said that both Ed and Eric are to blame for what happened.
The defense
wants to talk all about Ed Campbell. And make no mistake, Ed Campbell was a horrible man. I heard those jail calls just like you did. But this attack was brought on by two men. Two men who stood outside of that door on New Year's Eve and made conscious choices and deliberate decisions to end the lives of Jerome Faulkner and Dora Faulkner.
She said it's worth noting that the witnesses who had all testified about Ed's violent behavior never reported anything until after Eric was arrested. She said the prosecution is not downplaying the environment Eric grew up in and how it may not have been the best, but he made conscious choices and deliberate decisions that brought everyone into this courtroom. She said at one point in one of the jailhouse calls, Ed said he wants to form a plan to get to Holly and to talk to her, but he tells his sons not to threaten or hurt her. You wouldn't have to tell that to somebody unless you thought they might do that, she said. She implored the jury to find him guilty. And they did. Eric was found guilty of all counts. He was sentenced to life in prison. Jerome and Dora Faulkner's family released a statement after the verdicts were handed down. This day has been a long time coming. We have waited over 2.5 years for justice for Jerome and Dora Faulkner, whose lives were taken in such a brutal and horrifying way. It is hard for us to find any joy in this situation. We are ready to move forward with our lives, taking the memories of Jerome and Dora with us. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to know what you think about this case. Do you agree with the verdict? Do you think Eric had a part in what happened to the Faulkners? And if so, what do you think the punishment should be? Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, by tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.